Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we're talking with Christine Gray. Welcome, Christine, to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tim.
I think I said this in last week's show, but I have this horrible habit of just sort of launching into conversations with people because just about everybody I think I've ever talked to is really sort of fascinating. And people will then call in or I'll see them and they'll say, so who was that person you were talking to? completely they're given any background about them or mention their name more than once. So why don't you tell the folks listening a little bit about your background? It doesn't have to be, I was born and but just something, sort of the thread that runs through your life that brought you to this point where you're now working at VCU, I guess.
Yeah, so I guess that's the most important thing is why I'm newly living in Richmond. I just got a job at VCU straight out of grad school. I just finished my MFA at UC Santa Barbara.
What's that like?
Santa Barbara?
No. Getting a job straight out of grad school at VCU.
Bizarre and wonderful.
Yeah.
I feel completely lucky.
I mean, the people who know about VCU, and I guess most people do now, I mean, it's one of the better art schools in the country now.
That's what I was trying to tell everyone on the West Coast.
Yeah. But they weren't buying it, huh?
They just haven't heard of it.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's okay. Nobody here has heard of the West Coast either.
No, it's true. All the West Coast artists that I knew, no one has heard of them.
No one's ever heard
of VCU.
They're
really well known there.
Really?
Like, I worked with this woman, Jane Callister, at UCSB, and in Southern California, she is, like, a ubiquitous name in painting.
Right.
And she's been in lots of, like, fade-on catalogs and on lots of good shows, and you say, Jane Callister here, and people are like, who's that?
Really? That's amazing.
But there's a really weird divide between East and West Coast that I think needs to be overcome.
Well, I knew there was a divide certainly in styles, but I didn't know there was also sort of a divide.
I don't even think there is a divide in styles right now.
Communication. No?
Not that much.
No.
I mean, the stuff that I see coming out of, I mean, there's a definite divide in attitude toward what's being made, but not exactly in the way things look.
Right.
And I think that some of the stuff that's happening in the painting printmaking department now with the grad students would look just as normal in any LA gallery as it
really?
Does here.
Oh, that's interesting.
Or in New York.
Well, you would think
maybe
in a world,
I just don't have a good handle on it. Or
I don't know, but I mean, in a world of email and voicemail and texting and all that stuff, that's just striking that there would be people that would be that well known and other people wouldn't know about them.
But you know why it is?
No,
it's really
it's
really simple. It's because when you're in school, the artists that you think are famous and important are the ones that come and give talks at your school.
Right.
And somehow you hear about, or other ones that you hear about from your friends, and maybe they heard about them from school or something like that. I mean, that's not the only way. And then there's, like, maybe regional publications or something.
Right.
But so whenever you see them in a national publication, people you've heard of or met, you take note of them. But then there's all the other artists that you just can't keep track of.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's just a self-feeding system. People don't bring East Coast artists to the West Coast schools. There's plenty of schools and plenty of artists over there. They don't need any people from New York. And we don't bring anyone from California.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think that's part of the problem.
But anyway, I mean, it is an extraordinary thing for someone to come out of, I think it is anyway, for someone to come out of graduate school and land a job here at VCU like that. How's that strike you?
Well, I kind of wonder if they were crazy or something, actually. But now that I'm doing it...
You know, we can't edit this.
I think that, yeah. I mean, now that I'm doing it, I feel like they made it a good decision, and I'm good at teaching, and I don't know. I have a promising career, but I guess they were just willing to take a chance on me.
Yeah, because the competition's very stiff, for those of you who don't know.
Whole time you're in grad school, you are kind of worrying about the end of it coming,
right.
And that creates like a whole set of competitive attitudes between you and your peers, and it's not direct competition or anything, but just this feeling of that you will be about to fail or something afterward. Yeah.
Who's going to go on painting and who's going to become a housewife or whatever?
But I was actually really relaxed about it because before, when I, between grad school and undergrad, I was just a waitress and I worked in my studio and that was fine.
Right.
I didn't care. I mean, it didn't really bother me to have a job where I wasn't respected and didn't make that much money and had to work crappy hours.
It didn't bother you.
Yeah, you know, I was kind of angry like a normal person, but but I didn't want to go and do any. I didn't want to do.
I mean, it didn't bother how you felt about yourself, particularly.
Not really, because I felt like I had my own life and my studio that was more important.
Okay.
And so I didn't really care what my job. It was the point was just to make as much money in as little time as
possible.
Time,
yeah, right.
And to not have any kind of creative investment in the job, and I didn't want it to have anything to do with art.
Right.
And I thought when I got out of grad school, well, you know, maybe I'll just go back and wait tables again.
Uh-huh.
Why not? Yeah. I almost wanted to do that more than go and try to scrounge up a few adjunct jobs at all the schools there.
Yeah.
And drive around LA like endlessly.
Yeah. But yeah, and get paid nothing and no benefits and, well, we won't go into that.
But it's a good situation here.
Yeah, I think it's pretty it's pretty extraordinary. So, just a little bit more background. I mean, obviously, people have deduced from this that you're young. What got you started? What have you always made art? Was this something that happened last year?
Definitely not all of a sudden. Well, I don't know. I mean, when I was really little, that was the first thing I wanted to be was an artist. Mm-hmm. Until I found out about like Van Gogh being dying in poverty and. And then I was like, okay, I'll be an architect. No, I'll be an engineer. And then by the time I was a junior or senior in high school, I was back to wanting to be an artist and art major in art. And then I followed through with that. And I mean, although I had my doubts about what kind of artist or what it meant to be an artist or if I could really do it, I've always been really motivated. And I don't know, I never let myself fail at anything yet.
Yeah.
So
have you... Well, I think when some people, because part of the reason for the show is to sort of build the gap between people who sort of know a lot about art and people who don't know much about art. But was drawing something that came naturally to you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was something that you always
I always drew. Able to do. That's why I spent a lot of time alone in my bedroom just drawing for magazines and stuff.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your work, because. I don't know. Do you get accused of being having crafty work, of work that's craft in any way? Does anybody ever
say that to you? It's not that I'm accused of it. People seem to enjoy it and compliment me for my use of craft, not for my use of realism in my paintings, because there's two levels of craft in my work. There's first, I make these models that are very craft material based. And then from those, I basically will paint from them like a still life in a realistic way.
So you build the models?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're more like mini sculptures than they are like still lifes.
Right.
And they're made out of just things you would find at a craft store or a hardware store or something.
How much do you put into those? I mean, would they stand on their own, do you think?
A lot of people say that they would, and I've had lots of visitors come into my studio and say, wow, that would just be a really good sculpture.
Right.
And then I turn to them and I'm like, well, I'm just going to try to make it a better painting. And when I was struggling for a while in grad school with that question of whether the models were better than the paintings or, if I could make them go beyond the three-dimensional models. And I think I finally did, because even this... Sorry.
I mean, that's interesting. Go beyond the three-dimensional models.
Because those are already really cool on their own.
Right.
And people are really attracted to things that they think they can touch. And I think that that's one reason that it's so appealing to see sculptural things. Is because especially things that look like you could make them too.
Right.
Like my paintings have a high level of skill that goes into rendering them.
Right.
And so people are more in awe of that kind of skill. They're not, they appreciate it and they, some people
enjoy it. Yeah, I mean, that's very obvious
it.
In your paintings. Yeah.
But the models have a lower level of craftsmanship. Yeah. But anyway, and they, I think that they, because they look so easy and fast and cute and uh-huh. kind of hip, I think, and there's a lot of art that looks like that also.
But I mean, you're using things like, I mean, one of the words, let me just read something here. Maybe it'll help people understand what we're talking about here. But something I think you said, did you say this?
That's my writing, yeah.
Yes? Okay. Outside the art context, crafting plays an important cultural role. From early childhood through late adulthood, which is certainly true. I mean, there are lots of people who are involved in making crafts. Magazines such as Ready Made, Bust, which I never heard of, but I guess...
It's a feminist magazine.
Is it? Okay, yeah. That's probably why I never heard of it. Martha Stewart Living, which I obviously heard of, and Make promote a craft for all attitude. But each publication presents a contradictory set of aesthetics, financial, and technical limitations to their readers. The goal of having one's craft project look and function, like the example in the picture, is at odds with the reality of missing the mark in execution.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well,
an interesting concept.
Well, I think that it's, on the one hand, let's just take scrapbooking, for example. So when I was in high school, there wasn't much interest in scrapbooking or knitting. And as I entered college, an interest in young people knitting was simultaneously growing alongside an older and younger interest in women in scrapbooking.
When you say scrapbooking, what does that mean?
Scrapbooking?
Literally just...
Yeah, it's just the old-fashioned version of like making books with little pieces
pictures.
Of paper and little doodads and stuff, except that during this resurgence of it, it got really marketed and they have all these scrapbooking products and scrapbooking stores and everything was really packaged and really particular and basically it takes out a lot of the creativity.
Right.
And, on that hand, it's kind of bad, I guess, because it's offering it to people, but it's saying like, oh, here's how you do it. You just put this on this on this.
You can be...
It's just a ready-made package of how to make a craft.
Yeah, well, you don't risk failure as much, although in the end, I guess you sort of fail totally.
You do fail totally.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it just offers it to a wider audience.
Right.
And it just says you can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's more important to emphasize on the wider audience focus of you can do this. And Martha Stewart Living magazine does that as well. And I think that it presents it in a similar way. Like, it's too packaged, it's too perfect, and normal people do not have the money, the time, or the skill to make things as well as are made in the magazine. And while it may set one up for ultimate failure and make that customer feel bad about themselves in a way, on the other hand, it's giving them experience where they're working with something tactile and they're creating something and they're feeling very like... I would not want to use the word empowered, but some similar synonym that doesn't sound quite as strong.
I guess
playful,
in a sense, playful. Yeah. Yeah. That's probably a really good way of saying it. In a capitalist society and in many societies, and I've talked about this before, but the whole concept of play, which is big in philosophy and big in a lot of really sort of abstract, when you start getting to abstract levels of thought. I guess what this does is it says to people, it's okay. Right?
Yeah, and it's also,
okay.
It's a game for adults, really.
Yeah.
And
so how does that show up in your work?
Well, I guess by my process itself is very... Playful. And I try to engage,
but
in
the most sophisticated sense. When you say play, we're talking about exploring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I do that three-dimensionally. When I sit down at my table and I just like start making little doodads and models, it's to me the same thing as any general person sitting down and cutting up construction paper or making a poster for school or whatever it is. And then those things are translated enough in the paintings that one can tell how easily they were fabricated.
Right.
And the type of materials that they're made out of, and the types of colors that they're, you know, the color of the materials is related to the types of saturated colors that come from craft store aisles. And I also try to work with particular sets of colors that work as a palette. You know, the way that you would look at one spread in a Martha Stewart Thanksgiving October issue, and everything would be very well coordinated, or you would go to Kmart and see her products and they would be very well coordinated. I try to work with really pared down palettes in each painting. Really? And that's another allusion to that kind of thing.
What are you trying to do? What's your end game with all this?
End game?
Yeah.
Painters don't have an end game. My ultimate goal?
No, not an ultimate goal, but I mean, is there something that we haven't talked about that you're trying to accomplish through building models and then painting those models that we haven't talked about? I guess that's what it feels like.
I think that the higher goal or whatnot is to play with the viewer's perception of our own, of the reality that I make for them in the painting. And by overtly over and over again pointing to the fact that I'm making it, I'm orchestrating a whole scenario and a whole situation where everything that I make is very synthetic in the model.
Right.
Like, I have made like these strawberries that were made of cones that were made of fabric or something. And it's like, it's so far removed from the real that it draws attention to like a greater distancing from what we see as real by putting in a lot of extra steps in presentation. So in a lot of ways, it's just about representation. And it also is a lot about the way that we fantasize through making our own worlds, through crafting is a central part of the way that some people construct their own realities. And that's where I start off, because for me, that's my personal background. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we all construct our own realities.
Yeah, well, you have to.
Yeah.
But there's a certain...
But how do you articulate that?
But in my work, I make these... What we haven't said is that these models resemble landscapes, and that's the main thing that we haven't hit on.
Right.
And that there's a level of like trying to evoke a really fake nature in each one. And so not only is it like overly constructed and made too many times and highly synthesized, but it's also that. But it's a space, and it's a space that one fantasizes themselves being in, because it's kind of so like wonderful and magical, or I don't know. That's what I hope they'll be.
You also said the failure to embody the ideal is an important theme in my work. Failed geometry, failed architecture, and failed illusionism are treated with humor in my paintings and sculptures. And we've talked about that a little bit.
Yeah.
Just in terms of that. But can you talk about that some more?
Yeah. Well, I did a lot of pieces with cardboard where I did some small paintings where, to make the model, I challenged myself to like just kind of make a little model based on some intuitive process in like under, 5 minutes or something. And I came up with this one thing. I saw this project, and it was these perfect dodecahedron forms made out of really flat, super perfect cardboard.
What's a dodecahedron form?
It's a kind of geometric solid.
Okay.
And it has, I don't even know if I know exactly what it is.
Right.
That's how failed it is.
Right.
I don't even know what it is.
Right.
But I love geometry and like how rational and perfect it feels. And so to make something, so I made this little cardboard version of it, and I just kind of like hand cut out some pentagons or hexagons or I don't know what they were, but they definitely weren't regular, and it was crushed cardboard and hot glued it together and turned it into this little mini handheld semi cave or something. And that was sort of where I got that phrase. I made a series of those, and I made this one lemming that was three sad cubes with ears and paws on it. And
what was it called?
Cubist lemming. Cubist lemming. It was like the lowest common denominator of what is an animal is like three boxes with like some ears and paws on it, you know, like it didn't even need a tail or a face or anything. And that was an animal. And so it was like the failure of representation.
So are you constantly dealing with and struggling with the perfection that we pretend to have around us in so many ways, and the reality of the failure that we so often really have to live with? I mean, because you said something interesting. You said, "I've never let myself fail." About 10 minutes ago, you said, "I've never done that. I've never let myself fail." I mean, it's real, you know, it's like, I've never let myself fail. And yet it almost sounds like, you know, in your work, you're talking about almost making fun of perfection.
Yeah.
And then you make fun of perfection, and then you do these perfect paintings.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, this is weird. Is that
Yeah, I don't know if that's fully resolved right now in my mind. I don't know. I mean, so making the perfect paintings of the failed things is funny and
ironic.
it elevates failure to like something that I actually want to think about, or actually something that someone actually wants to look at and see differently. They'll never see it differently. A crumbled piece of cardboard is a crumbled piece of cardboard, and they're never going to see it differently unless it's presented in a different way. And like painting it beautifully so it's like luminous and like has, you know, crunchy little edges and stuff on it would maybe, I don't know, make someone see a regular crunched piece of cardboard some other time and see that as like a beautiful object.
Is painting intellectual for you, emotional for you, all of the above?
It's pretty much just intellectual.
Is it?
I'm really not emotional about my work.
That's interesting.
I mean, the only emotion about my work I have is a fun, happy emotion that's like related to
the intellectual process.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I have to have the humor there, and so it's intellectual and humorous at the same time, and then it's completely joyful for me, and I want that to be translated to the viewer as well. Right. It's like I want them, they're totally serious, and they're totally funny, and they should be taken seriously and lightly, hopefully.
Yeah, there's a lot of diametrically opposed things going on here. You also said, "I use lowbrow craft kitsch materials in my paintings and sculptures in order to reinforce a theme of the comedy of craft." Not comedy as in funny, but this aspect of my work critiques the Martha Stewart Institution for its presentation of perfect craft, food, entertaining, and interior decor as an everyday goal. So you're constantly playing with that perfection non-perfection seems to be a big part of what you're attempting.
Well, I think, I don't know.
You don't know if you agree with that?
No, I am dealing with, I mean, I'm dealing with ambivalent feelings because I think that it's a more interesting way for art to operate, to use ambivalence and to offer two opposing points of view at the same time and let the viewer kind of deal with those things because
what influences you? I mean, what if you're not coming from an emotional place, if you're not coming, you know, abstract expressionist background, who have been the influences? Have they been more philosophical, more philosophy, more political, more mathematical, engineering?
Mathematical? I don't know.
Did you mention engineering?
What?
You mentioned engineering as a possible career, so there must be some interest.
Yeah, I never made it. But I don't know what influences. I mean, I don't know what particular one thing drives me.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I have found a lot of support for the way that I think in theory that I've read.
So theory,
like
really?
Freud's definition of ambivalence was reexamined by Homi Bhabha, and he wrote some essays on hybridity in the 60s, I think.
Uh-huh.
And Freud's definition of ambivalence is like to love and hate something at the same time.
Right.
And that's the definition of critique for me. So when I say critique Martha Stewart Institution, it's a love-hate relationship.
Okay.
And I feel like that way of thinking and representing things is more engages the viewer more, and that's an important aspect.
Why aren't you a writer, or are you a writer?
Oh, I'm not really a writer.
You're not a writer. That's interesting.
I like writing. I mean, if I'm forced to do it, I'll sit down and do it. But I'm a maker, you know. I like I always want to have something going in my hands, and I've always been like that. So, I don't know.
Go ahead.
I mean, I don't think that I'm happy with words as a communication tool.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot can be done visually. And there's a lot of great writers that are doing things with words. And good for them, you know. But,
But it's more challenging and more meaningful and more whatever that other thing is that nobody can ever articulate, to take an idea like you were talking about with Freud and to experiment with that in a visual context.
Yeah.
And
I mean, it's
so. Do you start with an idea, or do you?
I don't know. Sometimes I start with a phrase that I think fits with everything that I've been doing recently, so it somehow, you know, rings a bell or something. So. Right now, let's see. I made this painting called Fruits of the Forest Crumble.
Right.
And I was just reading a recipe, and I was like, it was an Italian cookbook. That's why it's called Fruits of the Forest Crumble instead of like blackberry cobbler. And it was translated from Italian, so it sounded weird. And I was like, oh, that's the best image. And then it was this image of like fake geometric blackberry shapes crumbling with all this brick wall. It had nothing to do with
cobbler.
Sort of
like it was falling
off
the painting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, and then another, I've been looking at more food related or recipe title things, I guess. I made one called Rabbit Terrine because terrine is the land or terrain in French.
Oh, okay.
And then, but rabbit terrine is a traditional French food. It's like a hors d'oeuvre, a mousse or whatnot. And, but I made this landscape painting out of that idea of that food, another landscape painting. And it has some like disembodied rabbit ears.
Feminism. Stuff. Does it play any part in what you're doing? Do people often make reference to that or not?
People always ask me about it.
Do they?
And it's not something that I address specifically.
Yeah.
And I do feel like the feminist art movement did allow me to not think about it.
Well, that's an interesting statement.
It's been explored, and you can, you know, one may still find things to explore in that area, but it also just allows other women to just be artists, and, you know, if my work looks girly because it's crafty, that doesn't need to be the first thing on my mind every day when I go into the studio, because it's a non-issue, and a lot of other artists my age that I've talked to feel the same way. I was on a panel when I was at UCSB with four of my female colleagues, and we were asked by the feminist, the Women's Center or something, to do this panel discussion on like how our work relates to feminism. And we were kind of miffed because we all don't directly think about it every day.
Right.
Although all of our work has a level of like handcrafted look to it or something that might look feministy or dainty or something.
Right.
And then they got really angry with us because we didn't talk about feminism during the panel discussion. And they were like, what did your foremothers do for you? And we said they let us not have
not,
this discussion.
Not have to deal with
we're happy right now. This is it.
That's beautiful.
Thank you very much.
That's beautiful. That's great. Well, I'm afraid we're out of time, if you can believe that. It zooms by. But I think that's a wonderful way to end. And I think that's a wonderful answer. Well, thank you for coming on to Zero Hour and talking about your work. I know sometimes it's easier. You just want to look at me and say, well, just go look at the work, William. What are you doing talking about it? So thank you for doing that. And thank you, folks, for tuning in to Zero Hour. We're on every Friday at 12:30. So you can eat lunch with us. And once again, this is Tim Bowring, and this is WRIR 97.3. It's indie radio. It's radio for the rest of us. Have a great week.